for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives on March 12th at 1 p.m. at the Florence Schwimley Little Theater at Berkeley High. Tickets are $35. Call 510-582-7699 or visit alba-valb.org. alba-valb.org. No pasarán.
You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno, or online at kpfa.org. The time is a little after 1 p.m. Up next is Guns and Butter. Stay with us.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Essentially, what these exercises imply, where they envisage would-be terrorists coming in, is really to create a consensus among top officials that the enemy is real, that the enemy is real, that the threat is real, and that if there is a terror alert or a fabricated terror attack, these officials will toe the line and will ultimately accept unspoken, which is the establishment of military rule in America. In other words, martial law.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 3. Michelle Chosadovsky is professor of economics at the University of Ottawa and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Michelle Chosadovsky has written a new book, America's War on Terrorism, which is a new and expanded edition of his 2002 international bestseller, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th. This expanded edition, which includes 12 new chapters, focuses on the use of 9/11 as a pretext for the invasion and illegal occupation of Iraq, the militarization of justice and law enforcement, and the repeal of democracy. According to Chosadovsky, the war on terrorism is a complete fabrication and is a war of conquest. Washington's agenda consists in extending the frontiers of the American empire to facilitate complete U.S. corporate control while installing within America the institutions of the Homeland Security State. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome again.
It's great to be on the program.
Michelle, in your book, America's War on Terrorism, you take a look at the 9/11 Independent Commission report, their book actually, and the evidence that they have presented to the public on the events of September 11th, 2001. You have a whole chapter called On the Morning of 9/11, What Happened on the Planes. And in this chapter, you take a look at what the commission claims happened on the planes in terms of phone calls that were made from passengers to relatives or friends on the ground. What did you find out when you examined the report on this subject?
Well, first of all, the 9/11 Commission report is full of falsehoods and statements which are simply not corroborated by documentary evidence and can be refuted. But what I did in this chapter was quite specific, because essentially what the 9/11 Commission report is to try to portray these Arab terrorists, their hijackers, and the relationship they had to the people on the planes and what was happening inside the cabin. It was a complete narrative. Now, that narrative was based almost exclusively on cell phone conversations between passengers and their relatives or loved ones on the ground. And so that there's a sense on the part of the 9/11 Commission, there's an attempt to establish what happened on the planes based on these telephone conversations. Now, when I started to investigate this matter, I was a little bit puzzled, because I've never been able to use my cell phone on a plane. And then I started to look at the technology of wireless communication, consulting very reliable sources. And what they say is that, first of all, when you're above 8,000 feet, it's virtually impossible to place a cell phone conversation to the ground. And even below 8,000 feet, it's very doubtful. And if you look at very authoritative sources like a Wireless Review or even sources emanating from the telecom industry, they will say unequivocally, they don't actually say we don't think those calls happened, but they'll say we really can't explain how those calls could have got through from a technological standpoint. What I tried to do was to check altitude and these telephone conversations, and some of them were allegedly, of course, because we're talking about, you know, we're still talking about what the 9/11 Commission states. Some of them were placed at low altitude, but most of them are actually placed at 30,000 feet. And so I traced the relationship between the calls and altitude, and then came to some understanding of whether these calls could have got through or not. Now, it just so happens, and this is very ironic, that just as the 9/11 Commission was submitting its report, and that was back in July of 2004, American Airlines and Qualcomm Corporation proudly announced the development of a new wireless technology which will, at some future date, allow airline passengers to use their cell phones to contact family and friends when they're on a commercial aircraft, okay? And this was published, again, in a very authoritative magazine called Aviation Week. And essentially what they're saying is that the passengers are not able to use their cell phones on board. If they were able to use them on board, well, why would they go to the trouble of developing in a new, expensive, advanced technology of wireless communication, et cetera, to implement this procedure? And essentially, the conclusion one gets is that given the wireless technology available on September 11, 2001, these cell calls could not have been placed from a high altitude. The industry is unequivocal on this. The crucial link in wireless cell phone transmission from an aircraft is altitude, and beyond a certain altitude, which is usually reached within a few minutes after takeoff, cell phone calls are no longer possible. The only way these passengers could have got through to family and friends using their cell phones is if the planes were flying below 8,000 feet, yet even at low altitude, below 8,000 feet, cell phone communication is of very poor quality. And so that was essentially the basis upon which I undertook this investigation, and I came up with the conclusion that this whole narrative simply doesn't have much credibility, because a large part of the description regarding these 19 hijackers relies on cell phone conversations. And they go to tremendous detail of saying what they were doing and goodbye, mom, and so on. Okay, there's a whole narrative of people, and it is dramatic, of course. And the conclusion to which I came is essentially that while a few of these cells, according to the narrative of the 9/11 Commission report, were placed at low altitude and could have potentially gone through, the wireless technology was not available. And on that, expert opinion within the wireless telecom industry is unequivocal. In other words, and I'm very cautious in my conclusion, at least part of the Commission's script or transcript, which is in Chapter 1, what happens on the planes. And that's crucial. What happens on the planes is very crucial to their whole, to the credibility of their report. And I come to the conclusion that at least part of the Commission script in Chapter 1 on the cell phone conversations is fabricated. Because according to American Airlines and the Qualcomm announcement, the technology for cell phone transmission at high altitude will only be available aboard commercial aircraft in 2006. That's an announcement they made 2 years ago. And This, I think, is an inescapable fact. And to my knowledge, that technology has not yet been installed on aircraft. Of course, what the 9/11 Commission needs desperately is that this narrative on board the plane actually sustains the idea that these Arab hijackers, these terrorists, are there interfacing with passengers with their knives and threatening people and so on and so forth. And we go through a lot of conversations of how they're threatened and so on and so forth. And, of course, they need this type of material to sustain the 9/11 legend, and they need it to sustain the illusion that, in fact, these terrorists were on board threatening the passengers and ultimately crashing the planes into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. What we have is a narrative. It's the narrative of what happened on the plane with the Arab hijackers. And, of course, in a much broader sense, this commission script of what happened on the plane is an integral part of the administration's disinformation campaign. It gives a face to the enemy. And it also constitutes, of course, a justification for the anti-terror legislation under the Patriot Act. And, of course, it's also a justification for the preemptive war agenda against terrorists and rogue states.
Your new book, America's War on Terrorism, in that book, you refer to an evolving totalitarian system, and I assume you're referring to a global totalitarian system. And I know here in the United States specifically, of course, we now have a homeland security state. You talk about a July 2004 report called Planning Scenarios and a Universal Adversary. Could you talk about that?
Well, first of all, let me say that this evolving totalitarian state, which is essentially the militarization of civilian institutions, is an ongoing process in different countries. I think it is taking place at the national level rather than at the global level. But certainly, if we look at anti-terrorist legislation, we see it emerging in the United States, in Canada, in some countries of the European Union, particularly in Great Britain. Certainly in Australia, we see the anti-terrorist legislation, and the recent anti-terrorist legislation in Australia is very much in that direction of establishing some form of de facto military rule under civilian facade. Now, what you are referring to pertains to the U.S. National security agenda and the various anti-terror exercises which were implemented by Homeland Security against would-be terrorists. So that the universal adversary is really a creation of Homeland Security. It's an artificial, abstract concept where they say, let's conduct anti-terrorist exercises to which a number of governmental organizations as well as civil society organizations will participate, and then we simulate what would happen when this universal adversary attacks us. And so I examined this type of scenario for several reasons. First of all, by conducting these anti-terror exercises, which were called top-off, but the top-off exercises of Homeland Security means top officials. Top officials, that means that essentially they were conducting exercises with the participation of top officials from a number of agencies of government. And they were participating and analyzing and acting in the case of a terrorist attack scenario. And what those exercises, from my point of view, signify is that what the Bush administration is doing is trying to build a consensus within the state apparatus, within civil society, within the military, within law enforcement organizations, at the municipal level, among top officials who may have to act in the case of a terror attack. And so that, in effect, they are nurturing these top officials into an acceptance of martial law, because martial law would be triggered if you have a red code alert. And a red code alert could be triggered under any circumstances. The issue there in these exercises is not really to make America safer. Okay, that is not their purpose, because the enemy in any event is elusive and fabricated. It's a totally unreal scenario to say that Osama bin Laden is going to come in and bomb the United States, and that you have to have Northern Command headquarters, etc., and ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons to defend against Osama bin Laden. It's a totally absurd scenario. But essentially what these exercises imply, where they envisage would-be terrorists coming in, is really to create a consensus among top officials that the enemy is real, that the enemy is real, that the threat is real, and that if there is a terror alert or a fabricated terror attack, these officials will toe the line and will ultimately accept the unspoken, which is the establishment of military rule in America, in other words, martial law. And so we have a whole logic behind these exercises.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You know, Michelle, we even see this on a local level. In my local paper, I will see they'll have pictures of terror drills, and they'll have some of the people, I suppose, in local government or state government taking roles. Some play the terrorists and some play the victims, and they lie around in high school gymnasiums and pretend that they're patients. So I can see what you're saying. It looks like they are conditioning government officials to accept this whole reality.
Absolutely. These exercises are not meant for the broader citizenship. They're not even the object of major media attention. They're mentioned in the media, but they're not on the front page. They're not there to say, please be prepared. What they are doing is they're very specifically addressed to top officials, okay? They cover the entire range of agencies of government at the federal, state, municipal level. They also involve other types of organizations, including businesses, non-governmental organizations. And essentially, they establish these scenarios, which they call planning scenarios. And then they say, okay, we have potential conspirators, Islamic terrorists, and then we have state-sponsored adversaries or rogue states. But they also, it's interesting in this identification of the universal adversary, they also include the domestic enemies of America, which are the domestic radical groups, which I presume include anti-war and civil rights groups. And they also include another category, which they call the disgruntled employees, okay, quote unquote, which I presume are the labor and union activists. And so they are, in a sense, preparing the Big Brother law enforcement apparatus, which might eventually be used against potential domestic adversaries, including the disgruntled employees and the domestic radical groups. And so this is, I think it's a very disturbing process, because there's absolutely no evidence that the homeland is threatened at this particular stage in history, and that this requires a multi-billion dollar homeland security apparatus with Northern Command in a state of readiness and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, etc. It is totally fabricated, because the enemy is fabricated. Now, there may be certain threats to national security, but they don't come from Islamic terrorists, and they don't come from disgruntled employees, and they don't come from radical groups. And so what the administration is doing through these exercises is really to build a consensus within the state system that this is a legitimate war, that America is under attack, that the Islamic terrorists do constitute a threat, and so on and so forth. And so they are, in a sense, they're building a consensus among top officials. And that is, of course, a very dangerous process, because if the top officials believe in this, or are led to believe in a targeted propaganda campaign using these exercises, well, then top officials ultimately also set the agenda among their subordinates. They will be interfacing with people in their various offices and so on and so forth.
Exactly. You know, when I would see pictures of these terror drills in the newspaper, it always seemed so senseless to me. Except now, from your point of view, that this is building consensus among, you know, state and local officials, it makes infinite sense for them to be doing this.
Well, absolutely.
Absolutely. And these terror drills are called top-off because they're actually sessions for top officials. Now, they had a top-off 3, top officials exercise 3, in April 2005 that included, according to your book, 275 government and private sector organizations. And I also read in your book that top-off 3 was taking place simultaneously with terror drills in other countries, specifically one in Canada called Triple Play, and then the one in Great Britain called Atlantic Blue.
That's correct, yes. It was an Anglo-American homeland defense initiative. It included the participation of Canada's Ministry of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness, which is a kind of a copy-and-paste version of Homeland Security. And then it also included Britain's Home Office. And so they conducted, in separate exercises, but on the same day, they conducted simulations of attacks by Islamic terrorists, and they had 5 separate venues in 3 different countries to conduct these terrorist exercises or anti-terrorist exercises. And in each case, of course, they simulated attacks with chemical weapons or even with a radioactive dirty bomb. That's the kind of scenario which is envisaged, and then it creates among officials the idea that in fact these Islamic terrorists are coming in with weapons of mass destruction, they're going to kill civilians, and they have these mock terror attacks, and all of that of course contributes to sustaining first of all the legend and the illusion that Islamic terrorists are the main protagonists of weapons of mass destruction. They even have nuclear weapons, while, of course, well-known and documented, the United States of America is allocating a $450 billion budget, of which a large part is, in fact, intended to build up the weapons of mass destruction, which the United States is using against the rest of the world.
And also involved in these exercises, these top-off exercises, including Atlantic Blue and Triple Play, is the envisioning of a Code Red, which would include the suspension of civil liberties and even the suspension of civil government. Could you talk about the continuity of government, the shadow government?
Certainly. I think that Americans have become used to the idea of Orange Code alerts since September 2001. So Orange Code alert is high alert. It doesn't necessarily put the country into a martial law situation, but it also creates the expectation that someday there's going to be a red code alert. And so that red code alert is not something which we should necessarily exclude. Whether this red code alert is based on something which is real or unreal is not really the issue. In fact, it provides legitimacy to this war on terrorism agenda. Now, what will happen in a red code alert is the fact that civilian government, as it exists today, would be suspended, perhaps temporarily suspended, and a form of parallel government or shadow government will be established. In fact, this is called Continuity of Operations Plan, or COOP, and it's also known as Continuity of Government, or COG. It's a secret shadow government, and it goes back actually to the Cold War era, but it would become operational in the case of a Code Red alert. And it would mean the redeployment of key staff to secret locations, and it would require that federal agencies establish plans and procedures as well as alternate facilities, setting up of alternate facilities. And it would also mean that Northern Command would ultimately take over, because we'd be in a martial law situation. So that essentially a Code Red alert would suspend civil liberties. It would, of course, it would prevent any form of public gathering or citizens' protests against the declaration of martial law, and it would provide the emergency authorities with the ability to do what they want. They could censor the media. Well, they'd probably most probably censor the alternative media. They might close down the internet. They can arrest people, and so on and so forth. And then you have, and I think that's another disturbing component of this entire process, is that you also have in America these so-called citizens corps. They could become a form of civilian militias or paramilitaries. They're involved in law enforcement activities in neighborhoods. You also have this so-called neighborhood watch program of the Department of Justice, where you can spy on your neighbors and so on and so forth. So that essentially the suspension of civilian government in the case of Red Code Alert is something which is certainly envisaged. And it would trigger a whole series of responses by federal, state, and municipal governments. And it would also imply the transfer of authority to the military in many cases. And it, of course, would suspend civil liberties. It's something which certainly could be triggered at any moment. It could be triggered, let's say, in the context of a war against Iran, okay? Let's say the next phase of this war may be accompanied by changes, very significant changes in the national security environment within the United States. And the purpose of these code alerts is essentially to create an atmosphere of fear and intimidation across the land. And ultimately also the acceptance, not only by top officials, but broadly by the population, that the state is there to guard their safety and make the world safe and so on and so forth, and ultimately to galvanize support of the citizens in favor of a martial law situation.
What I found very interesting in your book, America's War on Terrorism, when you're discussing the April 2005 Top Officials Exercise 3, that is Top Off 3, simultaneously with Triple Play in Canada and Atlantic Blue in Great Britain, you say that Atlantic Blue in April 2005 was a mock terror drill in the London transportation system.
That's correct, yes, it was.
And then you point out that Visor Consultants was on contract to the British government in Atlantic Blue in coordination with U.S. Homeland Security. And, of course, when we all remember the London bombings of July 7th, 2005, it was Peter Power from Visor Consultants that went on BBC and said that this Visor Consultants was conducting a mock terror drill of a bombing in the London subways at the exact time that the bombings took place.
That is correct. Now, what happened is that Visor Consultants was involved in organizing Atlantic Blue, and as a result of Atlantic Blue, which took place in April of this year, they had envisaged, in fact, an attack on the London subway. And then the same company involved in organizing Atlantic Blue on behalf of the British authorities and on contract to Homeland Security, was involved in a similar type of scenario, an exercise for a private company, apparently, according to Visor's own statement, and that this took place exactly on the same day as the London 7-7 attack. So that on the morning of July 7th in London, Visor Consultants, which had previously conducted these exercises in the context of the top-off three framework under the British component, which was called Atlantic Blue, was then involved in replicating virtually these exercises on the very morning these attacks occurred for a private company, which involved the participation of top officials of the private sector. So we must ask ourselves the very important question, how is it that these terror exercises, which were conducted prior to the real event, actually replicate the real event in some curious way? And one would expect that if Pfizer consultants had any foreknowledge of these attacks based on their experience from Atlantic Blue, etc., that they would have made this information available to the British authorities prior to the actual occurrence of the 7/7 bombings. But in a bitter irony, those 7/7 bombings occurred almost simultaneously with the conduct of an anti-terror drill by Pfizer consultants. I should mention, and it's certainly very important, that on the morning of 9/11, there were also a couple of drills which were replicating 9/11. One was run by the CIA. It was a drill of an aircraft slamming into a building, and it was conducted on the very morning of 9/11. And then they say, oh, well, it was just a coincidence, et cetera, et cetera. And there was also another event in New York City where a similar scenario was being planned. So we have to ask ourselves some very important questions. How is it that these terror exercises seem to replicate in great detail the real event? And how is it that on the same day when these terror events occur, whether it's 7/7 in London or 9/11 in New York City, how is it that on that same day we have agencies of government or consulting firms involved in scenarios which replicate the real terror attack?
Yes, they have to have something to do with each other. The fact that they would have a drill of the same event at the very same time the event is taking place is too much.
Absolutely. I should say that it doesn't necessarily prove anything, but it's very puzzling that this kind of situation would occur. There are too many coincidences which are there and which are not investigated. I would suspect, and that's what I suggested, in my writings, that if Pfizer consultants conducted a terror exercise on the same morning, well, then this should be the object of a police investigation. And is there any connection between the scenario and the real event? So it can't be simply dismissed as a coincidence, particularly when that coincidence has been repeated so many times, both in relation to 9/11 and the July 7th. Bombings in London.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Also with regard to the London bombings, Scotland Yard warned the Israeli embassy, who then warned Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to go to his meeting, which was taking place that morning in a hotel that I believe was over one of the train stations where one of the bombs went off.
That is correct. There was a report. It was actually a mainstream press report. It was never actually denied that the Israeli embassy had foreknowledge of those attacks. And they had warned Benjamin Netanyahu not to go to an event which was planned at a hotel close to where the bombing was taking place. And I think that, of course, is very, very significant. It doesn't necessarily prove anything, but again, it's something which has to be addressed in the investigation. The report of the Associated Press correspondent in Jerusalem says very explicitly, quote, just before the blast, Scotland Yard called the security officer at the Israeli embassy to say they had received warnings of possible attacks. the official said. He did not say whether British police made any link to the economic conference which was being attended by Netanyahu. But the fact of the matter is that this report does suggest foreknowledge both by Scotland Yard and of course, the Israeli embassy.
Yes, the London bombings were full of weird coincidences. Another weird coincidence, Rudy Giuliani is right there in London when the thing happens?
That's correct. Rudy Giuliani was actually staying at the Great Eastern Hotel, very close to where one of the bombings was held, and also where the economic conference organized by the Israeli embassy was scheduled to take place. And so when the bombings occurred, Giuliani was apparently having a business breakfast meeting in his room at the Great Eastern Hotel, and then he felt the bombing, et cetera, and he took cognizance of the incident. And so I think that's, of course, very important. It should be understood also that Rudy Giuliani is also involved, has a security company, which is called Giuliani Security and Safety. And that particular company has been also on contract to the U.S. authorities in the context of similar mock terror drills and emergency preparedness procedures. And I should mention that Giuliani Security and Safety LLC has had business contacts with Visor Consultants, which, as we mentioned earlier, was involved in the terror drills conducted on the morning of 7/7, as well as the Atlantic Blue terror drills. So the presence of Giuliani is mysterious. It, from my point of view, it doesn't prove anything. But again, it's one of those. It's a whole set of coincidences which I think requires very careful investigation by the British authorities.
Michel, you've done a lot of work on some of the accused bombers in the July 7th, 2005 London bombing. Some of those people who have either been arrested or accused of taking part in the London bombings. I'm thinking here of Naeem Noor Khan and Haroon Rashid Aswat.
Yes, indeed. Well, let me make a few comments on that, because the four alleged suicide bombers pinpointed by the British authorities were said to have actually planned the attacks of the London bombings in Pakistan in coordination with several Islamic organizations. And the Islamic organizations which are mentioned are the two main Kashmir rebel groups, Jaish-e-Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba, both of which have ties to Al-Qaeda. Now, when the investigation was conducted, the London police authorities sent a team to Pakistan, and they collaborated with Pakistan's military intelligence, the ISI. Okay, the British investigation was conducted in collaboration with the ISI. Now, it just so happens the ISI, and it's fairly well documented, is known to have supported both of these two Kashmiri terrorist organizations, Lashkar and Jaish. And so then we might ask ourselves, why is it that the British are actually collaborating with the main Pakistani entity, which is said to have supported these two terrorist organizations? I think that's the first aspect. The second thing is the fact that the British investigators uncovered the fact that these so-called Yorkshire bombers were in contact with a mysterious Pakistani engineer called Mohammed Naeem Noor Khan. And this mysterious Pakistani engineer, who was described in the British report as being some kind of a mastermind acting on behalf of Al-Qaeda, and that on his computer they had found the maps of the London Underground and so on and so forth, and that this individual, Naeem Noor Khan, was in contact with the London bombers. and that in fact there was some kind of a summit held in Pakistan where they actually planned this together with Noor Khan. Now, when these reports came out, I started investigating the assertions regarding Naeem Noor Khan, because I recall that Naeem Noor Khan was the center of an earlier terror alert in the United States at the height of the election campaign. In fact, it was in August 2004. And the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge at the time had said that Noor Khan had top secret information on an impending attack on the World Bank and Citigroup facilities on Wall Street and so on. And he had put New York City and Northern New Jersey on Orange Code alert as a result of so-called reliable intelligence out of Pakistan from the computer of Noor Khan to the fact that they were planning to attack America, and those were the targets. And all this was, of course, identified as very, very reliable intelligence. Now, it just so happens that the FBI confirmed in the wake of this investigation in August 2004 that the material on Noor Khan's computer included outdated pre-9/11 pictures and diagrams, etc., which were publicly available off the World Bank, but none of this material pointed to an impending terror attack on Wall Street or the World Bank in Washington, D.C. And so that, in fact, the FBI simply said this is a load of, they didn't say that, but they said that there's nothing there which points to any involvement of Noor Khan, and that this information from the intelligence standpoint is irrelevant. And there was never at that time any indication that Noor Khan had maps of the London Underground on his computer. What happened and what resulted from the FBI investigation was simply to dismiss the information of Noor Khan outright. And that was the end of the matter. And essentially what happened is that Tom Ridge had called this Orange Code alert at the height of the election campaign. In fact, it was called on the very same day as Kerry's acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention. So it was serving an agenda back in the United States. But what happened is that the British authorities then more or less picked up on this Noor Khan connection. And they added a whole series of incorrect statements. In other words, it was disinformation. They said that Noor Khan had secret maps of the London subway, which, of course, was already refuted by the FBI investigation of 2004. They also said that Noor Khan was participating, quote, in an Al-Qaeda summit in which the London bombings were being planned, and so on and so forth, and this was all conveyed in various news reports. But bear in mind that following Noor Khan's July 2004 arrest, where they had nothing against him, right, he wasn't arrested, actually, and put in jail. He was actually hired by Pakistani's military intelligence on a CIA project. And this is confirmed by press reports. The computer information was discarded as irrelevant, and Naeem Noor Khan, the alleged terrorist, according to the London police authorities, who was arrested in July 2004, he was neither accused of masterminding a terror attack on Wall Street and the World Bank, but he was in fact recruited by Pakistan's intelligence authority. And I quote from the press report, it says, Khan had been arrested in Lahore on July 13 and subsequently turned by Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency when his name appeared in print in early August 2004. He was working for a combined ISI-CIA task force, sending encrypted emails to key Al-Qaeda figures in the hope of pinpointing their location and intentions. So the point that I'd like to make in that is that at the time when this alleged Al-Qaeda summit was held with the Yorkshire bombers and Naeem Noor Khan, who was the alleged mastermind of this Al-Qaeda summit in Pakistan, Noor Khan was, in fact, on the CIA-ISI payroll. So that all this discussion on an Al-Qaeda planning summit in Pakistan is absolute, total fabrication. It is inconsistent with the press reports, it's inconsistent with the FBI report, and by careful analysis of media reports and police reports, you actually can demonstrate the fact that this police narrative concerning the planning of a terror attack in Pakistan is simply not verified by, it's contradicted by earlier police reports, and consequently, I would say it's fabricated. And that is, of course, a very serious result, because it points to the fact that the British are, in fact, fabricating rather than investigating. Now, there was another, I think, very important revelation regarding the London bombings, and that had to do with an interview, actually it was an interview on Fox News, a very reliable source, and Fox News had interviewed a former CIA official, John Loftus, and John Loftus went on U.S. network television, in other words, Fox News, where he actually pointed to the fact that the Yorkshire bombers were an intelligence asset of MI6, in other words, the British Secret Service. Okay? And he said, yes, the Brits, the British intelligence are behind these guys, and he actually gave quite a lot of detail on that. I give the part of the transcript of this Fox News interview in my book, and I quote from John Loftus. He says, quote, "Some people say that the British intelligence fibbed to us. They told us that Aswad was dead, and that's why the New York group dropped the case, etc." And so what Loftus is saying is that the Yorkshire bombers had contacts with British intelligence, and he also says that British intelligence were supporting a Muslim organization called Al-Muharijun, which was a London-based Islamic organization used to recruit volunteers to serve as mujahideen, going back to the war in the Balkans.
I'm speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The War on Terrorism, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And you're speaking about Harun Rashid Aswad, whom I believe made many trips back and forth between London and South Africa. I think he was picked up in Zambia. And then it turns out that he is working for MI6, or at least has affiliations with MI6. And he is part of this, as you mentioned, Al-Muharijun.
That's correct. Now, what John Loftus says is that, in fact, the British had picked up this mastermind. He was arrested in Zambia. And this mastermind was apparently the person behind the Yorkshire bombers, called Harun Rashid Aswad, okay?
Okay.
Now, Harun Rashid Aswad was part of this Islamic organization, Muhajirun, and he allegedly participated in the recruitment of volunteers in Britain's Muslim community who were then sent to fight as mujahideen in the Balkans, particularly in the Kosovo Liberation Army. Okay, and that seems to be fairly well documented. Now, what John Loftus is saying, black on white, is that the guy who, according to the British authorities, namely Harun Rashid Aswad, who is the mastermind behind the Yorkshire bombers, who actually is said to have recruited the Yorkshire bombers, and who is also from West Yorkshire, where the alleged bombers were living, that this individual, according to Loftus, is in fact very closely linked to British intelligence. Okay, and he says, this is the guy, and what's really embarrassing is that the entire British police are chasing him, and one wing of the British government, MI6, or the British Secret Service, has been hiding him, okay? And this has been a real source of contention between the CIA, the Justice Department, and Britain. Now, what Loftus is trying to say, because, I mean, he wants to cover, well, I'm sorry, he doesn't want to actually start broadening this discussion. He says that this is really a struggle between British intelligence and the CIA. He says British intelligence are supporting terrorists and they're not telling us about it and they're hiding him, etc., etc. He doesn't, of course, go into the broader implications of his statement, because if MI6 indeed has links to the Yorkshire bombers, well, then one would suspect that this implies treason at the highest levels of the British government.
Exactly.
And that is, of course, if I read that statement by John Loftus, that is what I... Either John Loftus is not saying the truth, but he's a well-established intelligence analyst. Either he is simply misleading us, which is always a possibility, or he is indicating information which suggests that the British government is involved in acts of treason. And then on the other hand, if you tie in his assessment to the Pakistani connection and the Al-Qaeda summit in Pakistan, well, then you realize that you come to the conclusion that the intelligence agencies are connected to these so-called Yorkshire bombers. And then you say, well, there's something very fishy in these reports. So what I've attempted to do in that last chapter is certainly not to provide a complete coverage of the London 7/7 bombings, but to provide a number of inconsistencies, to analyze a number of inconsistencies which serve at least to refute the main narrative of the police authorities, of the British police authorities, and A, the issue of terrorist scenarios on the same day, B, the phony Al-Qaeda summit in Pakistan with Pakistani military intelligence involved in the investigation, when we know that Pakistan military intelligence supports Al-Qaeda and supports the Kashmiri separatist groups with which the so-called Yorkshire bombers had contacts. Thirdly, the fact that the Al-Qaeda summit was in fact chaired by somebody who, according to press reports, was already on the CIA payroll. And fourthly, this connection of the terrorist mastermind arrested in Zambia, who, according to John Loftus, CIA analyst, was linked up to MI6. So, you know, all these inconsistencies, I think, constitute the basis of an understanding of 7/7. And I can't simply swallow the main findings that this was a terrorist attack and that nobody in the British government or the British Secret Service or the police didn't know about it. And then add to that the fact that the Israeli embassy was warned prior to the attacks.
I wanted to reiterate the fact that the last chapter of your book, America's War on Terrorism, is called The London 7/7 Bomb Attacks. Michelle, this is a terrific book, I think, America's War on Terrorism. It really covers a lot of material. The war on terror, the state-sponsored terrorism, the financial warfare, the geopolitical, military, global strategy, etc. It's really an incredible book, I think. Is there something you would like to say overall about the book?
Well, what I've tried to do in this book is, first of all, to go through literally hundreds of media reports, official statements, with a view to verifying or refuting official statements on terror events or the war agenda or the national security agenda. I think that what is required is to reveal the lies and the media disinformation. And that is not an easy task, because to do it, you have to prove it. And to prove it, you have to essentially find statements which contradict official statements. But fortunately, the thing is that all this literature of official statements and media reports has the main characteristic of contradicting itself. So that when you look at a particular statement by a particular official, which says, well, we have to wage a war on terrorism. Well, you're able to refute that because you know that the war on terrorism, in fact, is fabricated by the Bush administration, and then you can prove it. And you don't prove it in a single statement. That's, I think, the nature of my book is not to make a single sweeping statement that the war on terrorism is fabricated. My book, what it does is to go through hundreds of documents which points in that direction, that the war on terrorism is fabricated. And this is absolutely essential because it has to be based on something which cannot be refuted. The description here is based on things which cannot be refuted because they are using the same sources of information as the main media sources, pointing to contradictions, pointing to statements which then are refuted, and so on and so forth. But I think what is important is not to keep the analysis at that level, it's then to integrate it into an understanding of how the New World Order is evolving, both nationally and internationally. The national security state in America, on the one hand, the global war agenda at the international level, on the other hand. And my work, I think, is essentially there to provide the anti-war and anti-globalization movements with the ammunition that they need to disarm the New World Order, to question the legitimacy of those occupying positions of authority, and not to be strung in anti-war sentiment or in a mode where they would say, well, please don't bomb, okay? We have to use this information in a way which will ultimately disarm the main agenda, which is the war on terrorism. We have to show that the war on terrorism is fabricated, and we know that without the war on terrorism, which is the building block of U.S. military doctrine, the entire justification, the justification for waging these wars, collapses like a deck of cards. And that is ultimately what has to be achieved.
Michel Chosadovsky, in your new book that we've been discussing, America's War on Terrorism, that is available on your website, www.globalresearch.ca. Michel, can people get a hold of you? May they contact you through that website?
People can contact us through the website. There's a contact email. They can contact us. We usually respond to all emails that we get, as many as to the best of our abilities. They should visit our website. We have a vast archive of documents on the New World Order, on very diversified set of contributions from very carefully researched articles as well as news reports.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be on the program, and my best wishes to everybody in California.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
I've been speaking with author and professor of economics, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The War on Terrorism, Part 3. His website, www.globalresearch.ca, contains articles he has written, as well as articles by researchers from around the world. That's www.globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yaro Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Tonight, Wednesday, March 1st, the 9/11 Film Festival continues at Humanist Hall in Oakland. Tonight is a screening of Loose Change. Film at 7:30, doors open at 6:30 p.m. I haven't seen this one myself. I'll be there with your favorite shows from Guns and Butter. That's Humanist Hall, 390 27th Street in Oakland. Loose Change, tonight at 7:30.
soul.